I've been drinking water out of a hollow log. I've been drinking water well out of a hollow log. When I went around here, get a good man like a dirty dog.
Well, that was John Barney. They were Model T Ford. I'm David Preece, and this is Planet Poetry. A warm welcome to everybody, croeso cynnes. In a few seconds, you'll hear the lovely tones of Matthew Jarvis, and we'll be chatting about the goals of this podcast series and what's coming up in the next few months. Later, we'll have some live blues from Model T Ford, and we'll be joined by band members Damon Walford Davis, Richard Magrath Turley, and John Barney. Sadly absent will be Dilwyn Roberts Young, but you can hear his wonderful harmonica being played in some of the blues tracks. The boys will be discussing performing their own poems, and some ideas about performance, and a little bit about how poetry fits into the blues. And stay tuned until the end, because we have a wonderful live debut for you coming from the Reverend Davis.
Oh, honey dear, sweet, sweet man.
Thanks for coming in, Matt.
That's my pleasure.
Yeah, we're going to be doing a lot of this over the next few years.
We are.
Tell me, when I asked you to accommodate this podcast in your life, what aspects excited you?
Well, there's a variety of things, really. The chance to talk to poets, because I know you're keen to get poets in, and we've got three of the fellas from Model T Ford joining us today. The chance to have that conversation. I love asking poets about what they think about their own work, about teasing out their ideas. So the opportunity to ask those questions is really important to me. But also we want to be talking about new collections, what's come out, who's new on the block, what's the latest collection from the more established poets. And we want to get a sense of what the Welsh presses are coming out with too, because obviously they're not just concerned with Welsh poets or poets who are in some way associated with Wales. They have quite a wide reach in many ways. So, you know, let's see what our presses are doing. What are they putting out? What is the contemporary poetry scene in Wales all about? Hopefully in its broadest sense. That's what I think excited me, Dav.
I'm also looking forward to listening to what people have to say, because maybe some poets have got too used to putting words on a page, having a lot of time to respond to things, listening to some real hearty responses, and hopefully you'll be goading them on with some very insightful questions.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I'm certainly going to try. And that applies to people who write about poetry too. Someone like me, I'm very used to putting my thoughts on the page, very considered. So hopefully it will put all of us on our mettle a bit more to be talking about it live. Critics to poets, maybe we'll get some publishers in. That would be quite interesting.
That would
it?
Be very interesting. Actually, any publishers out there, if you want anything talked about on this podcast, just send the books through. You know, we'll be setting up Twitter links and Facebook links underneath. Just get in touch.
Yeah, send things through to the Planet office, really.
Yeah, yeah, very good. And of course, with the podcast, what we're looking forward to is getting all sorts of poems read out as well. We're going to be getting guests in to do readings of their poems as well, and then getting a good feel about what those poets think about how their poems should be read.
I think that's really important. And, you know, Rhiann Edwards last night won Wales Book of the Year 2013, and she's someone who is perhaps particularly known as a poet who is a performing poet. But maybe we wouldn't want to make a simple distinction between poets who are performance poets and poets for the page. And I guess the guys who we've got in today may have something to say about those sorts of distinctions, or maybe they might want to push those distinctions around maybe a little bit, say that they might not exist. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to have that conversation, isn't it, Dav? That's an important issue that we're looking at. How do these issues of performance, poetry on the page, how do they relate to one another?
Well, we're not going to be able to ignore
all this issue, especially seeing as everybody's going to be listening to this rather than
Absolutely,
reading it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a very, very apt time to be looking at it, especially, like you said, with Rhian Edwards winning Wales Book of the Year earlier. I think it was last night, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was last night.
On that note, I suppose congratulations are in order.
They very definitely are. A bit of a clean sweep, really.
Indeed, and I won't be asking anything of one of the Model T Ford boys later, because maybe he won't want to talk about that.
Well, I think it might be hard, because Richard Margraf Turley was obviously one of the judges, and Damien Walford Davis is now chair of Literature Wales, isn't he? So I think we should let them off the hook. They've kind of, well, Richard has made his statement by awarding the 2013 award where it went, so I think we let that just stand as it is.
Absolutely, and John Barney can rail against the system as much as he wants then.
Absolutely, I wonder if he'll rail against the system.
Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to this. I don't know about you, the long years ahead of us talking about what's going to be happening in poetry in Wales, I wonder if we'll have the same tone come 12 months time, come 24 months. Who knows? I wonder what we'll be talking about.
That's very interesting. What's going to happen next? Well, I've been sent some books by some of the presses, and I think next time we may be talking about three Seren books.
All right.
That have come out in 2013, so maybe it's worthwhile flagging that up. Seren sent me, they were the first press off the mark, so to send me some books. So we've got Shadow Dispatches by Polly Atkin, who was the winner of the Maslexia Poetry Pamphlet competition for 2012, and we've got a book by Marianne Burton called She Inserts the Key, which I think is actually up for one of the Forward Poetry Prizes. It's the one for first collection, I think. And then Catherine Maris, a book called God Loves You. And so we'll get a chance to talk about some poetry collections next time, but not today.
No, we've got a lot to get through today.
I
have to say, Seren seem to be doing some great work at the moment.
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, I think one of the things that is worthwhile saying is that Catherine Maris's collection is quite different, say, from Marianne Burton's, and I like that. I think kudos to publishers when they put out a range and a diversity. I think that's really important. The poetic culture needs that.
Yes, lovely. No, I think that's absolutely right, and we'll be digging into those in the next podcast.
We will indeed.
However, for now, totally fitting for the first Planet Poetry podcast, it's the lads minus Dilwyn Roberts Young from the band Model T Ford. You did a gig, I think it was about 3 weeks ago in June, in the Round Studio in Aberystwyth Arts Centre. It was blues and poetry and kind of intersections of blues, and then somebody would do a reading. On that point, I wonder if one of you Model T boys would be happy to tell me a little bit about, you know, what you feel about performances as poetry first.
Well, for me, it's always a leap of faith, a leap into the dark, really. And it's making that transition from the page to performance is something, well, I approach with trepidation, and often the effects that are generated are the ones you least expect. And I suppose, in a sense, that's what you want, the unexpected.
For me, I always look forward to performing poetry, not because I'm a performance poet, as some people may understand performance poetry, but maybe that's something we can come back to, because I'm not somebody who likes to make distinctions between poetry on the page and performance poetry. But I look forward to it because I tend to gravitate towards the dramatic monologue, where one throws a voice and therefore one feels odd not performing or throwing that voice. So that kind of ventriloquization aspect of things, I welcome a stage for that.
Well, Damon, you raised the idea of the relationship between poetry on the page and poetry performed, and you weren't necessarily keen on making a distinction. Can you talk a bit more about the relationship and why you don't want to make a distinction, especially for you chaps involved with performance and, you know, playing the blues regularly?
I mean, this sounds really under-theorised in a sense, but I mean, I do think that there is good poetry and bad poetry, and one should stop at that. I think all poetry, all good poetry, is performable. And so that's one very direct way in which I think that a distinction is not actually helpful between so-called performance poetry and so-called mainstream poetry. I always like, you know, some members of the alternative poetry scene who can figure themselves very much as alternative poets, referring sometimes in a rather disrespectful way towards mainstream poetry. And there are only a few of these shrill voices. But, you know, the bone I'd have with that is mainstream poetry seems to me to be an oxymoron.
When you're making that distinction, do you mean what might be called a distinction between the neo-avant-garde, the neo-modernists, or were you talking and the mainstream, or were you talking about a distinction between people who primarily perform and aren't, and don't really do too much work for the page, and those who do primarily perhaps do work for the page? Which of those two things were you thinking about?
Both. Really, absolutely, okay. Both. Yeah, I mean, I do really think that all good poetry, dynamic poetry, challenging poetry, poetry that channels voices in interesting ways, whether that's a throne voice or a confessional voice, all those aspects can be performed and should be performed. So the idea of the page versus the stage is not an authentic distinction for me.
Well, mixed in with a lot of that poetry was a lot of blues. Again, Eno has a deep-rooted relationship with poetry. Is that why you chaps, you seek both of these performance styles out and you brought them in into under one roof? John, you've been doing blues for a long time. Do you have, you know, any spikes in your relationship with poetry and blues?
Well, for me, when I'm performing, I much prefer performing with music, both music accompanying the poetry and music interleaved with the poetry, because I think it gives a different pace, a different feel to an evening that a pure poetry reading of, say, an hour or an hour and 20 minutes with breaks, very few people can actually concentrate that long. But if you break it with music, be it blues or any other kind of music, then I think it adds a dimension to the poetry, that you concentrate on the poetry in a different way, really, from a straight sort of conventional reading.
And Richard, you play a lot of guitar, you've got your own YouTube channel, you do a lot of performances on that. And I know you break away a little bit from blues. Do you want to say something about, you know, whether you see the two things differently?
Sure, yeah. I mean, because I suppose most people would put jazz and poetry together. I suppose traditionally that's how it's done. But actually, the blues and poetic form, whether it's experimental or more traditional or mainstream, given what Damien has said about that the problem of that distinction, I think they are complementary forms. And blues lyrics are often seen as cliched or formulaic. You know, you can put together a blues song from off the peg phrases. You know, and I suppose the big cliche is "woke up one morning." And that's true to an extent, but actually the blues lyrics explore a spectrum of feeling that goes just beyond loss or you know, feeling down into place and memory, and lots of topics and themes and preoccupations that we associate with, you know, poetry in a more perhaps in a structured sense, or poetry as you know, you might imagine you're going to get if you go and see me or Damien or John perform. So it's that complementary energy that I think works for us, and certainly it was something we wanted to explore when we put on the event last month in the Arts Centre.
I'd like to say too that I think the blues is an oral poetry. It's the oral poetry of black people, first recorded in 1920 and recorded ever since. And both that Richard is right that earlier on the blues had a very wide range of themes, and those themes narrowed by the 50s and 60s quite considerably, which is the blues that most people are familiar with. And I think that the nature of blues poetry, because it is an oral poetry, is that if you look at the lyrics printed on the page, they can seem, as Richard says, cliche. They can seem rather dull, but it's a combination of the music with the lyrics which elevates the great blues singers into great poets. And I think any anthology, or true anthology of American poetry in the 20th century, would have to include people like Blind Lemon Jefferson, Robert Johnson, and so on.
So do you find, John, that your own poetic practice is influenced quite directly by your experience and your fondness for the blues?
No, I don't think so. I think for me they are two separate activities.
So in musical terms, I guess a lot of people don't know about the deep history of the blues and its many-stranded aspect. Could you maybe tease out a bit what the band, what histories of the blues the band particularly buys into and draws from?
Well, it's interesting that Richard, who's the lead singer, and I sing some blues, we come out of slightly different traditions. I came across the blues in the 1950s when not much was available, and what there was on 78 and 10-inch LPs tended to be pre-war blues, people like Blind Lemon, Lead Belly, Sleepy John Estes, and so on. And I, when I started playing blues, that's the blues I turned to, blues which is traditional and orally formulaic, and I basically make up my own blues using these free-floating stanzas. Richard, perhaps you'll correct me, I think comes out of a slightly later period. He's influenced by the blues of the late 30s, the 40s, and he's more concerned to recreate blues which already exist in a sort of recorded form.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction. I mean, listening to, in fact, I was playing back some footage, if we can call it that, of the gig, the Poetry Blues event in the Arts Centre. And one thing that struck me watching how John performed and how I performed is that I thought actually what John just said there about reconstructing a recorded version of the blues, in my head I think you're absolutely right, that's what I'm aiming for. But I realised looking at it that I was basically playing that recorded form that had gone through, you know, the 70s and 80s, almost appropriation of that oral tradition. And then I've gone back down the rabbit hole, as it were. So I think I was basically playing rock and roll, but, you know, as it might have looked in the 30s and 40s. Whereas John, who said that, you know, in a sense, he's creating the blues on the fly, as it were, using floating verses and off the peg phrases and a sort of bricolage, really, in a sense is much more authentic. So I'd say right back at you, John.
Well, Damon, you were playing essentially a box with a string attached. You look aghast at that.
Could you say that again?
No, I think
you've made your
over
point.
Here. And
yeah,
that.
even though he's wearing sunglasses, I can tell that his eyes are red with rage. You were playing bass.
For the untrained eye, it was indeed a box with a single string, and I do still get jip from the band members even, and the other member, of course, Dilwyn, is my friend, and he never actually teases me that I'm playing a box, but the other two sitting beside me do. To the untrained eye, as I said, yeah, a box and a string. It's actually a T-chest bass, and there are good T-chest basses, and there are bad T-chest basses, and there are good T-chest bass players, and of course bad ones. You can get a range of different sounds out of it. It's not merely a kind of melodic instrument, but it's a percussive instrument as well. And there are different ways of playing that one string with any number of fingers, well, 10 at least. The challenge is to get recognizable sounds out of it, but also to be the engine house of the band and keep the percussive, energy of the band moving, because it all falls apart if I'm not there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that percussion.
Yeah.
And that obvious note, I suppose, I'm going to tease out here is, you know, the aspect of percussion in a person's voice when they perform poetry, because one tends to look for the stronger syllables within sentences when you're portraying them for a crowd or an audience. Is that why you're doing this, or is that your access to this music world, maybe because you don't have ability with a guitar or something like that?
Did he say what I thought he said there?
He used the A word, yeah.
He did, yeah. Well, you know, I could have brought a piano or a violin in here, Dav, to play, to show you that I can play music. David, you ask direct questions. I like that. Let me give you a direct answer here. The answer is yes, definitely. There is a kind of percussive element to poetry as well. Going back to what the guys beside me were saying about blues, what I love about blues and how it connects to poetry is the repeated line. I love that kind of commitment that the blues has to repetition. But it's always repetition with a difference. It's always a kind of deepening iteration. That's true on the page. Because sometimes you inflect those small riders in the line, when you see blues printed. But of course, it's far more the case that's, you know, that the blues is endlessly changing and endlessly inflected when it's performed. You could have heard the other day during the performance that Richard and John were never repeating the same line. I mean, what you said about a percussiveness, an intonation, a difference in tone, a difference with substantive words, all that came in. So the blues is actually endlessly flexible. And, you know, Richard and I are academics in the day job. Dr. John Barney was an eminent academic in a previous life. And I teach blues poetry. I don't see, again, to level distinctions, I don't see any distinction between, you know, the rondo or the triolet or the villanelle and the blues in many ways. I mean, it's capable of the same kind of effect.
What's the blues poetry that you teach?
Well, I remember asking John Barney when I was putting this course together to give me some examples of some good blues that would fit with this course. And the course is on traditional poetic forms. And this particular weekly session is about repeated lines, about the power of repeated lines. Even when it seems on the page that it's a blank repetition, the challenge for students is to just inflect it so that you get a pun is generated or an emotional pun is generated. You know, the repeated line resonates in a different way. And that is, of course, the best way in which a villanelle might work. Mm-hmm. You know, the repeated line functions differently, and there's this deepening sense of acclimatization to the line throughout the poem.
So are you playing the blues to your students?
Well, all the students tend to come to our gigs, don't they?
They do.
I mean, they tend to be a staple demographic for us, which is, you know, they're clearly highly intelligent people.
And you were touching on notions of improvisation there, and that clearly, from what you're saying, John, about how you work, plays a part in how you produce the blues. What about improvisation in terms of how you guys produce your own poetry, Richard? Can I maybe drag you?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's something, I mean, Damien and I, who work closely or have worked closely together, still do when we write poetry. I mean, we thought a lot about this. So, you know, calling it a method would be to hang it too high, but we certainly, I don't think either of us would dream of putting something out without the other having seen the poem at least, and often having had some input. So, you know, you can see Damien's fingerprints over my lyrics and vice versa. So, but what that, the nature of that intervention, whether it represents a form of improvisation, I think the important thing to say would be that neither of us would think of a poem as being finished or even half finished before we show each other the poem. So in a sense, I guess what I'm saying is that there is a form of improvisation in that the poem remains contingent until that process of reflection and input has taken place. So I guess it's a form of improvisation.
I would tend to say that all poetry is improvisation, in the sense that, in my own case at least, when I sit down to write, I have no idea what I might be writing about, and that the excitement of writing, just as the excitement of for a blues man, I imagine, or a down-home traditional blues man, is that you don't know what is going to come onto the page or into your voice until you're actually in the middle of it. And certainly for the old blues men, a song was of indefinable length. You could, you know, it could be 2.5 minutes on a 78, or it could be 10 minutes in a field recording. And so there's a kind of elasticity in both the singing of the blues, and for me at least, in the writing. Poetry is, at the deepest level, a kind of improvisation, I think.
Well, on that note, I'm just going to drop in here one of the poems that you read out or performed. But this is an interesting one. It's called Harold. And on the night, I think you had Damien doing a little bass line behind it. So,
bass line now, is it?
Not, yeah, just it is a bass line. Yeah, I don't think Damien's ever going to forget that, is he?
No.
Thank God you're going to Cardiff. This is Harold from John Barney, anyway.
His body was a soft pink car sliding across the ice until it hit the barrier. Poor Harold. He'd be better off dead, according to the relatives, after a stroke like that. Metaphors abound. He was a single tree standing shattered in a field. His were the anchorite's bright eyes as the last stone was shoveled into place. His words were counterfeit, clattering out of a slot machine. When he said leaf, he meant please. Or a game of international Scrabble. Kisu, Kiti, Chakula. Tears were the surprise, signs of inner life stumbling through the brain. It's all right, Harold, it's all right. But it wasn't, and we knew. Our words as broken down as his, gold-covered chocolate kiddie's money in gold-meshed bags. The neurosurgeon had shaken his head. The priest who lives on water and bread had come up with no answer other than the time the vulture would be swooping soon to tear at what remained of Harold, leaving the bones for holy burial. Amen, we said. Amen. Amen to that.
Yes, so that was really interesting, John. What did you, did you come up with the base behind it? How did that come about?
Well, the poem is about a man who's had an incurable stroke and his speech is impaired and there's no way out of his situation. And what I wanted in the performance was for Damien to basically do a slow heartbeat, leapt up, leapt up, leapt up, which is what he did, which is the, the elemental life which is left in Harold, but where all the being, as it were, his personality have been destroyed by this terrible stroke. And I think the bass backing sort of gives that sort of sense of just impending the end of this man.
I thought it was brilliantly delivered. It's a fabulous poem anyway, but the depth that the extra level brought it alive magnificently, I thought. Have any of you performed poetry with backing before?
I don't think I have. I'm struggling to remember now. No, I don't think I have. I mean, we're sitting here a day after Sheehan Edwards has cleaned the board, poetry-wise, with all sorts of awards, Book of the Year-wise, with a brilliant collection. I mean, what Sheehan often does, and I've read with Sheehan, she brings a banjo and she sings and she interlaces the poems with a more recognisably kind of modern, musical lyric. But personally, I've never done that. Although, this band has always talked, haven't we, about mixing up blues with poetry. So there was a new experience for me. But at the same time, it was always in the genes of both the poetry and the music when we were doing just the music, as it were.
I've done quite a bit, actually, especially with Nigel Jenkins, Ewan Llwyd, and Tom Morris in the group, bilingual group, Bekindrwg, the Bad Boys, where we mixed poetry and music in this way, and also with some jazz pianists who improvised behind the stuff. And I find any kind of improvisation with music a very exciting way to, exhilarating way, really, to perform poetry, actually.
So have any of you guys sort of trying to persuade your publishers to put a CD in the back of one of your books?
Well, actually, just thinking about that, I have done that, actually. I worked with a guy called Sid Thomas, Howard Thomas. He's a professor of plant science, a geneticist, and we've worked together on academic projects. But we also, 2007, Sid had read my Fossil Box collection and was inspired to write some jazz tunes. And then we came together and I sang some of the lyrics, which was an odd experience because they'd been written as poems, not as lyrics. So it kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier. And then, and I think one case, I read them over the backing. And in the most extraordinary one, Jellyfish, Sid had some early software that would approximate to a human voice. It was called Lola, so Lola read out Jellyfish. And it was absolutely extraordinary, and in a sense, a far better performance and truer to the, to the strangeness of Jellyfish for me than anything I could have generated with my own voice.
You said something really interesting there, Richard. You suggested a conceptual jump between the poem as poem and the poem as a lyric. Can you explore that a bit more? Because that does seem to be at a slight angle to the sort of things that Damien was saying earlier.
Yeah, you're right. I suppose, and as soon as you perform a poem, I mean, that distinction between, you know, the stanza and the verse or the lyric, I mean, all those three terms are, they're all in sort of urgency and the currency there, and they're interchangeable to an extent. I don't know. I mean, I think it was a slip of the tongue more than anything else, but you're right. It does foreground a point that I suppose we need to nail down, actually. You know, what is the difference? Is there a difference? Is it always a, you know, an issue of context?
Well, we've been talking an awful lot about blues, so I think we should have a listen to what the band came up with on the night, and we're going to go with one of the efforts that Richard sang out. And yeah, it is interesting. I just want to, before we go into that, just want to say, like, the lyricality of it melts away into the musicality as well, and that's the beauty of blues in my view, is that it elevates the simplest of ideas to the stars almost, and you can see the struggles quite beautifully. So let's have a listen now.
Southbound train, may I take my body home? On that southbound train, they'll take my body home. And if you can't see my body, Lord, all you can do is moan.
So that's The Blues by the Model T Boys. At the end of the evening, how did you feel it was good? It was a success?
It was interesting, actually, because we... One story that needs to be told before we answer that question, really, is the change that my set of poems and Richard's set of poems went through during practice, because we gathered at John's house and we went through the whole set, music and poetry. And we found, Rich and I think it's fair enough to say that we found that John had chosen exactly the right poems to go with his set. And we can talk about why we felt they were right and why we felt that the...
Original
set was absolutely the wrong one. I mean, mine didn't fit the music at all in any way, even though I chose poems that I thought would connect with a set list, as did Richard. But there was something about the choice, as against John's choice, that really didn't work. So a couple of days before, we scrapped our sets and we came up with completely different sets.
What was it about the first choices?
I don't know. Richard, any ideas?
I think I know what worked so well with John's. John was writing about the enduring themes in perhaps a more explicit way, you know, love, loss, desire. And I think the poems I'd chosen were too clever in the worst sense. And they relied on puns and close reading, in a sense. I mean, they were poems for the page. So I ended up reading my rude poems.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think John was dealing with blues themes, which are the themes of one's wider articulation of the world. And maybe our first sets were too intricately focused on a passing moment, in a sense. But it's interesting that we scrapped our initial sets. Whether we thought it was a success or not, I thought we could hone it, actually, a bit more. I thought, as the first attempt of this band to do that multimedia thing, I thought it was very genuine, actually.
I like the reference you made to multimedia. Perhaps I can ask you all to speculate on how poetry and multimedia expanded performance could go. I mean, particularly for you guys in the band, where do you go from here?
Well, Richard and I have always used visuals for a number of poetry gigs, and we've often referenced those or used them dynamically, because they have been a living organic part of the poems themselves, because a lot of them are keyed into visual material. They're ekphrastic is the expensive word for it. And so we've often flashed up those images and used that, not merely to give the audience a sense that this is the image that this poem references, but to give a genuine sense of a kind of interdisciplinarity and multimedia experience. So, you know, one could graft the visual onto what we did 3 weeks ago very easily. I remember Dav and I were seeking out the sweet spots in the room just before when we were miking up, and Dav, you joked that it's a lovely round studio in the Arts Centre, and we were thinking of having a kind of U2 Zoo TV, running visual computer screen, running all the way around. I think we could use that in quite an interesting way, and again, in quite a genuine way. It's not the challenge is to do it in a genuine way, you know, rather than just have it as a kind of an add-on that isn't integrated organically into the experience that you want the readership stroke audience to have.
Yeah, and I think, you know, poetry purists may not like this, whatever, whoever they are, they may not like this, but just as John said that, you know, once you add a guitar to a blues lyric, suddenly, or Dav, you said, you know, suddenly it takes you to the stars. I think often, not always, but often poetry is lifted when there are other things going on, and it could be visual, it could be physical. But something happens when it works well. Something happens that perhaps goes beyond what the words alone would be able to deliver or produce.
Well, listen, how do you feel then now about somebody asking you to do a poetry performance, a reading, in the usual sense? You know, you got a book out, you go to Waterstone somewhere. Sorry, nice little plug there. But, you know, what's that going to make you feel like?
How much are they offering?
we'll get to them later.
R.S. Thomas once said that he wouldn't cross the street to go to a poetry reading, and there's a certain level where I tend to agree with that. I've been to maybe 4 or 5 absolutely memorable readings in my life, I suppose, and a lot of, you know, perfectly decent readings, but ones which you forget almost as soon as you've come out of the room. And so I feel that after doing the kind of performance that we've done, which I really like, that a straight reading is for me at least, a kind of anticlimax, I think.
How do you feel about that, Damien?
Well, my last collection was called Witch, and it's basically a play for voices, and that's what I wanted to write at that particular point. I wanted to write a poetry that would reach vocally, as it were. And so the first reading of that was a performance of it with 13 voices, Richard Margaret Hurley included. And, you know, that was really important to me, that that was a performable piece, that the verbal was, and there was an audio element to the verbal. And, you know, that's what Judas is all about, which is the next collection, which I, parts of which I also read. And I'd like to see that as a play in many ways, you know. And so the answer to the question is, I guess, going back to a straight reading to launch a book would feel kind of lo-fi to me.
Mm. Well, on that note, we'll jump into one of the readings from Judas. I think it was called Like, and we'll have a listen right now.
Branched sage was blooming yellow on the wayside, and here's me telling him, spare me the eternal similes. Like seeds, like nets, like this man, like another, like a child. This is worse than dark. Tell it like it is. He stopped. That maddening smile again. He said, the kingdom is, and tapped a finger on my chest. The scent of sage was like a song.
Yeah, so that was Like, from your collection Judas. So let's talk a little bit more about, you know, you alluded to it, what goes with what? Poetry with blues, blues with poetry. John seemed to have naturally landed on poems which flowed into the blues, and you two landed on sort of more performance style poems which might titillate the audience a bit more. Do we want to, you know, talk a little bit about where those two meet in a performance sphere?
I think John's well-judged list in the end sat actually quite logically with ours, even though I have to say that Richard's poetry is very different from mine, even though we collaborate. I mean, the voices are distinct and we recognise that, and I think our poetry is very different from John's. They're different kinds of lyrics in many ways. I mean, you know, I tend to go for a far more kind of pared-down style. I think Richard's pared-downness is a different kind of thing. And the tightness of John's is not in the same way pared down. It's a different kind of lyric voice. But I think that they all gel together in some way, whilst preserving the distinction between them. And I think that's important too. Because, you know, going back to what we were saying about repetition and the blues, it's always repetition with a difference, you know. So that was going on the level of the poetry as well.
Yeah, and I think also something we haven't mentioned is that we didn't read two or three poems and then Damon would read two or three, Richard would. We split them up so that there's a constant change of voice, constant change of tempo between our different kinds of poetry, as well as the change of tempo when we began a blues. And that's an important part of the entertainment value of a show of this kind, I think.
Isn't it also an important part of the musical experience that you're throwing between different instruments taking leads at different points, and so that you're actually just importing that musical approach into the way you handle the poetry in the evening as well?
Yeah, I think there should, in the show of this kind, and it is a show, that there ought to be a constant element of surprise, that the reader or the audience is constantly false-footed, in a sense, in terms of what they might expect.
Like, you know, that man is playing a box with a string. You know, that kind of level of surprise is just never wears off, really.
But is it a good box or a bad box?
Well, yeah, clearly it never, it's not worn off on Dav here.
We've got a few boxes in the attic, Damon, if you
don't
wanna,
even, don't push it.
No. Well, the blues itself is it's dynamic, it's different, it's powerful, it's passionate. The poetry on the evening totally held its ground against that kind of performance. It goes to show that, you know, with the right choices, there's a hell of a lot of entertainment out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Let's talk about class for a moment, because John was talking about the roots of the blues in slavery, really, and it's got this kind of mnemonic quality to the repetition as well. You could hear the incarceration of the form as well as the inflections of the form, And I'm just wondering, you know, poetry is now such a kind of middle class affair in so many ways. I'm wondering how those two things fit together. You know, we are three middle class white people, to be frank about this, apart from John. And, you know, that is something we've thought about. You know, you've got to think about these things, although the blues in 2013 have been filtered through so many different kind of cultural, you know, experiences that it is everybody's music now. But that's something that we have thought about. I think that's true, isn't it, Richard?
Yeah, and I would add to that. I mean, we often think of the blues as something that inhabits you. You know, you are taken by the spirit of the blues. But I think it's actually the other way around. It's about allowing yourself, or learning how to inhabit the blues. It's that way around. And as Damien says, if you're, you know, three, well, however John defines, Abergavenny Slim defines himself, but, you know, three white guys inhabiting a black oral tradition, it's difficult. And I think you have to respect the, you know, there are accommodations to be made on both sides, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, to be fair, I think the blues is obviously fairly new form, and that's the surprising aspect, is that poetry fitted in to this evening quite so easily.
Yeah, and of course W.H. Auden was, you know, right onto that. Those sort of the synergies between blues and poetry. What was it, 1939, Refugee Blues, you know, and that was written at a time when the blues was in its, I suppose, in its authentic first stage. You know, Robert Johnson died in 1938, John, was it?
Yeah.
You know, so it's still finding its archetypal form, and Auden was right in on that.
Well, this seems like a great opportunity to go into one of your readings from the evening, Elysians from Wan Hu. Do you want to say something about why this came up, why this came to you?
Well, Elysians was, Damien mentioned Throne Voices, the dramatic monologue form, and it's a form that's attracted both of us, really. And I suppose for me, and perhaps for Damien, the appeal is that the dramatic monologue form is, you know, what happens, what must happen in the dramatic monologue is that the speaker, and there's always only one speaker, gives him or herself away. And in my case, I battened on to the figure of a romantic period industrialist, a member of the Lunar Society, somebody who was ostensibly signed up to the abolition movement, but who was also selling steam engines to the plantations. So it's that sort of conflict. And the poem imagines this industrialist discussing the plans for a new improved engine. And in the process of talking about that, the language of slavery and exploitation, and also, you know, dark desire and sort of industrialism, all sort of, you know, sort of collide, and in the process the speaker gives away his own knowledge of his complicity, and it seemed the right poem to read. It was the first poem I read that evening, because it I suppose, you know, went back to the you know, terrible point in the history of slavery, but also a hopeful point, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's great. We'll dip into it now.
Elysians, with a note to say that the firm of Bolton and Watt sent 132 engines to the Caribbean between 1803 and 1830. Since you ask how it begins with elasticity of steam, with sun and planet gearing, wax and resinous bodies. It continues with inequality of pressure, with want of wind and water. It's put to work by the fly-ball governors, Gale and Long, and the amiable Pennant. I am a man of sector and rack, quadrant glass. I calculate the economy of heat. No, not of planter class myself. Look, these latest drawings regulate the speed of an engine, describe the action of vapour. Here, the descent in the cylinder, and, figure C, the condensate and vacuum. And here we find the endless reservoirs. Each night, this dream of dark bodies. My valves move by gears, very similar to Smeaton's.
We talked a little bit about the success of the evening. Do you think you'll do something like this, something similar again?
I very much hope so. I mean, Damien is off to Cardiff, but, you know, Cardiff Aberystwyth, separated only by a train route that goes through England. So I imagine we'll be seeing a lot of each other.
Yeah, I'd like to do it again. And, you know, I probably feel that we shouldn't do exactly the same set again. And we should constantly try to push the boundaries and do something new. Maybe adds another medium to it in many ways. Mm. We could even bring in guest poets to it. That would change the dynamic in interesting ways. Or we could even try to, you know, attune it to a certain anniversary or to a certain place. You know, it's endlessly adaptable in that way.
Because I just want to say that, you know, the actual gig was really enjoyable. And, yeah, I really do hope you do it again.
What did you think of Longest Train? Do you remember Longest Train?
This,
that was a great one,
infamous song by now.
Yeah. Who sang that one
much
again?
Heralded. I think it was sung by the Reverend.
It was sung by the Reverend, I think.
This much heralded song. This was Damien's turn in the spotlight, ladies and gentlemen.
It was Damien's debut as a singer.
Thank you. And what a debut. I thought
it was a real treat.
Thank you.
I hate to be honest on this point, but you have quite a nice voice.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That quite is working very hard for you
there. Life's full of surprises.
It is. I was very surprised.
All you listening to this, there's a TGS bass player for sale here, for hire.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to drop that song in right at the end of this podcast.
Well, you know, what can I say? What a treat. I envy people listening to this.
Boys, I can't thank you enough for coming in. It's a nice, hot summer day, proper summer day. We're all boiling, so I can't offer enough thanks for you to coming into this little office here. What are we going to say about then the next gig? Are we going to try and get something up in 2014?
Well, having had an opportunity to talk and to, in a sense, theorise the things that we were doing instinctively that evening, I think, you know, we will do it again and maybe do a few things differently.
Yeah, and we are available for hire for any launches, to be honest. I mean, needn't necessarily be our own poetry collections. John, do you think that's not selling ourselves, is it?
I wouldn't say so, no. I think it's spot on.
Yeah. Yeah,
artistic integrity, I'd say.
I think we're all integrity, clearly.
Well, here's the Reverend then.
And this is called The Longest Train.
We're going to conclude with a Deep South train blues called Longest Train. We're going to let the Reverend here loose on singing, something we've never done before. We don't take no responsibility.
We have to say it was not a majority vote.
But he really rocks it, so let's go on this one.
Everywhere spoken against. Okay, the concert begins. Longest Train. Longest Train. It was the longest train I've ever seen. It was the longest train. It was the longest train I've ever seen. It came out of Memphis. Yes, it did. It moved down to New Orleans. The engine passed at 5. I see the cab pass by at 9. The engine passed at 5. Yeah, I saw the engine pass by again at 9. I wasn't doing nothing. I was doing nothing. I was throwing away my time. Were you, honey, when the engine left the shed? I said, where were you, baby? Yeah, when the engine left my shed, I was crying on the back door, wishing to God I was dead. Ooh, play the blues, man. Honey D, sweet, sweet man. Okay, Mr. Engineer, can a poor boy ride your blinds? I
asked if he's through the engineer. Can a poor man ride your line? He said, I wouldn't mind it, sonny boy, but this big train ain't none of mine. That's what he said, John. Oh yeah, let me tell you people what that mean old train can do. Let me tell you people, yeah, now, what that mean old train will do to you. It'll take you right up, oh yeah, it will, boy. Blow black smoke all over you, honey dear. Sing to me, baby. Seen. Yes, I'm telling you, it was the longest train. That was the longest train I've ever seen. Where did it come from? It came out of Memphis and headed down to New Orleans.
Thank you.